It is a fact. Agriculture, like most industries, is growing in two directions, very big or very small. This leads us to ask, which provides for the greatest security, many small farms or few big farms?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with your host, Michael Olson. And now, get ready for 1 hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned into the 1255th edition of the Food Chain Radio Show. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends down there in Buenos Aires who are tuned in to the podcast as we stream along in the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What. Folks, let's begin with a pandemic story out of New Mexico. Like many rural areas in the United States, the consolidation of grocers has left many small New Mexico towns with but one or two grocery stores. In reacting to a recent spike in the number of COVID-19 cases, New Mexico Governor Michelle Grisham ordered a shutdown of non-essential businesses and severe restrictions on those businesses she deemed essential. One of the restrictions placed on essential retailers, like grocers, was that no store, regardless of size, could take in more than 75 people. As a consequence of that restriction and the food buying panic it engendered, New Mexicans were forced to stand in line for 2 to 4 hours just to buy some groceries. Now let's turn to another COVID-19 story, this one in the nation's meat supply. Consolidation in the meatpacking industry has left four companies in control of 54% of all chicken, 67% of all pork, 73% of all beef in the United States. When COVID struck the meatpacking industry and workers stayed home, the packers had to close down upwards of 25% of their processing lines. The shutdown not only reduced the supply of meat to consumers, but it also left farmers with animals they could not afford to feed. As a consequence, people went without meat, and hundreds of thousands of farm animals were euthanized. These stories, and many others like them, lead us to ask, which provides for the greatest security, many small farms or few big farms? Here to help us find an answer, we have Emily Miller, who is the Policy and Research Manager for the Family Farm Action Alliance. Emily, welcome to the Food Chain.
Thanks for having me on, and congrats on the 1255th episode.
Yeah, well, that's a lot of blathering, isn't it? Well, you know, the fun thing is that in all those shows, I don't think I've run across the same subject more than a few times, and life is always interesting on the Food Chain because you just never know what's going to turn up. And one of the things that's turned up over the last maybe two decades, I think, is consolidation. And I think, you know, when we look back on this era, the corporate we, in another 100 years, we'll see it as the era of consolidation and centralization. Would you say the same thing, Emily?
Yeah, I think, you know, especially over the past 2 to 3 decades, like you mentioned, we've really seen this push towards prioritizing efficiency and prioritizing profit and economic growth over some other measures. And with federal enforcement, where it's been, especially in agriculture, you know, we look to the Packers and Stockyards Act of 1921. We look at an agency under USDA that regulated grain markets and livestock markets that is no more because of these corporate interests looking towards efficiency. You know, so I hope, and it's the hope of the authors of the report that we'll be talking about, but it's the hope that, you know, we can look back and see it as a distinctly different era than perhaps one that we hope to move to.
Right. Well, let's talk about the Family Farm Action Alliance. First of all, what do you mean by family farm?
Yeah, thanks for the question. Well, the farmers and ranchers that we represent are those that are independent farmers and ranchers, and we hope to move those that aren't, that are perhaps growing under contract or are stuck on a treadmill. We hope to transition those to an independent structure where they can choose what they grow, how they grow it, and who they grow it for. And to get to your question by who we mean under family farm, that can mean a lot of different things for a lot of different folks. You know, we know that there are some more traditional examples of family farms where perhaps it's a husband and wife and the farm gets passed to the son and daughter. We also know that there's people farming who aren't relative but choose to farm under a cooperative structure. And so family means a lot of different things to us. We're just out there to help protect the independent family farmers and ranchers.
Okay. Action. Family farm, yeah. Action. What do you mean by action?
So for Family Farm Action Alliance, our action is research. We do research and policy development here. We do have a sister organization, Family Farm Action, that does our policy and legislative pushes. So Family Farm Action Alliance, our action is the policy and research world.
Good. And then alliance, that means you're a partner with somebody.
Mm-hmm. Well, I just mentioned we're a partner with a formal organization, Family Farm Action, but we're also an alliance with the many other food and farm organizations that are also doing the good work of promoting the independent family farmers and ranchers who are working to be good stewards of the land and promote an economy that is inclusive and respects all people in the food supply chain.
Good. Okay. Then let's talk a little bit about the research that you have been doing. You commissioned a report with some very interesting scholars, and that report was about what?
Yeah. So we were very excited to release on November 19th a report called The Food System Concentration and Its Impacts. We did do a virtual webinar for this. Senator Booker joined us, Senator Cory Booker, and you can find that at our website if you happen to miss it, along with a copy of the report. But back to the report, it is authored by Drs. Mary Hendrickson, Phil Howard, and Doug Constance. They are all three rural sociologists and agriculture economists who have been working on concentration in agriculture combined for decades. So they're the real leading experts on this. I was also lucky enough to be on the authorship team. And so this report, what it does, it takes kind of a contemporary look at where are we now in the agriculture sector with concentration. So the report starts by bringing us up to speed, looking at this globally concentrated system. We see the inputs needed to grow our food are all consolidated at very high rates. You know, in the intro, you were mentioning how much, what the percentage of a market that's owned by or controlled by four corporations. Well, in the inputs, we see seeds are controlled. The top four firms own 50%. Move to chemicals, the top four firms own 65%. So those are the inputs the farmers need to grow food. But then on the output side, when they go to market in the U.S., you mentioned soybean processing. The top four firms own 80%. And beef processing, the top four firms, that's 73%, and we can go down the line. And what becomes really problematic is it's the same companies that control each of these things. So you see it in beef and pork processing and chicken processing. JBS is in that top four and all three. Tyson, Cargill, So that's the concentration part, right? That's easy to see in the numbers. But what this report does, it goes further, and it shows how the farmers, workers, communities, and the environment are all connected. And then it goes on to talk about some possibilities for the future. So we were really excited to release this really groundbreaking report, and this will be the foundation that we build a lot of our future work on.
Well, good. And then with respect to taking on the consolidation and concentration, is that the same as centralization? You know, it's where you're placing all authority and all capability and all management systems in one place.
Yeah, we can definitely draw some similarities. So what we've seen in agriculture and, you know, across the economy more broadly, we just happen to look at it through the lens of food. What this concentration and consolidation has allowed is it's allowed what once was argued, you know, we're being consolidated for the sake of efficiency, for the sake of accumulating more profit. And what we've seen really is that's, yes, that is the case, but it's no longer the case because all of that economic power and political power has been concentrated in the hands of a few, so centralizing, just like you said. And what that power really translates into is the power to make decisions. So the power to make decisions about our food system, specifically what is grown, you know, corn, soybeans, we grow pigs, we grow beef. So what is grown, where it's grown, you know, there's a reason why Iowa has mass monocultures of corn and soybeans. How it's grown, we see synthetic chemicals, heavy tillage.
So all that decision-making process is focused in one office, who knows where.
Potentially on the same boardroom,
yeah.
And potentially not even in the U.S.
Okay, we're going to take a quick break, but when we come back, we're going to talk about how consolidation, concentration, centralization works on a farm and in the food industry. This is the Food Chain Radio Program. Michael Olson with Emily Miller of the Family Farm Action Alliance, and you. Do stay tuned. We will be right back.
History buffs, this tale from Michael Olson's Tales from a Tin Can took place while the USS Dale steamed through the Bering Sea, January 1943.
We took some terrible waves up there. One time a big groundswell rolled us over so far I thought we'd never make it back. I was on the lee deck when the ship went over into that roll. Luckily, I was able to grab onto a bulkhead handrail, and when the Dale went over, my feet left the deck. I hung there with nothing between my feet and the ocean but air. I was scared. She went over on her beam, paused for a minute, then she shuddered and shook because one of her propellers was out of the water and thrashing air. Slowly, very slowly, she rolled back toward the vertical, and my feet found the deck again. That wave scared the devil out of me.
Tales from a Tin Can contains 424 tales by 44 sailors aboard the USS Dale, from Pearl Harbor to Tokyo Bay. Order your Father's Day copy at talesfromatincan.com. That's talesfromatincan.com. talesfromatincan.com.
And now, more of What's Eating What on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Welcome back. We are talking about the consolidation of the food chain, wherein a few companies and a few people control what we eat, when we eat, and what we eat, essentially. And we're going to talk a little bit about how consolidation works and what makes it work. And I always thought it was the pursuit of the economies of scale that leads to concentration. What do you think, Emily?
It certainly used to be the pursuit of economies of scale, you know, pushing farmers and businesses to get big or get out. But now we see the consolidation. It's so huge that the scale doesn't really matter anymore. because of that decision-making power that we were talking about.
Mm-hmm. So are you saying that the economies of scale are no longer the big determinant? The big determinant is having the power to make all of these controlling decisions then.
Right. Yeah, economies of scale are still really important and perhaps used as the story behind why consolidation happened. But, you know, we argue it's at the point where scale is kind of a moot point.
For those people who do not know what the economies of scale is, I have a real quick example. Let's say Farmer Emily has 1,000 acres and Farmer Michael here has 1 acre. And Farmer Emily and Michael go downtown and buy a new $10,000 tractor. Well, that tractor costs Farmer Michael, with his 1 acre, $10,000 an acre. But Farmer Emily, who has 1,000 acres, only has to pay $10 an acre for the tractor. And that's how economies of scale are said to work. Probably a little bit far-fetched, but that's the idea. The bigger size you have, the more you can spread your costs over that size. But I always thought the real benefit to economies of scale was that it allowed one to essentially buy the government, buy access to the government. And if you have access to the government, then you can encourage the government to pass rules and regulations that allow you to defer the true costs of production. Emily?
Exactly right. I couldn't think of a better example myself. Yeah, so with the economies of scale, it's maybe not the farmer, you know, it's not myself having 1,000 acres that allows me to get the attention of the government, but it surely is the corporations that, you know, I'm buying the seed from and I'm selling my products too, that definitely are tilting the ear of the government for those policies, you know, such as subsidies to grow corn and soybeans,
right?
That hide those externalities.
So in essence, then, the economies of scale allows companies, corporations, or whatnot, to grow in size to the extent that they can then afford to buy influence of government. Let's see, Farmer Emily and Farmer Michael both have an interest in an irrigation project for their respective valleys, and Farmer Michael with 1 acre, to get the right vote, it would cost me, you know, $10,000, which would mean $10,000 an acre, but Farmer Emily could, you know, for only $10 an acre, she could get that vote. So there's a huge difference there. And in the power of that economies of scale with respect to having your way and having the ability to make those decisions that you were talking about.
Yeah, I want to make one important distinction. So the way farmers produce is, of course, important, but it's not the farmers that are buying the vote.
But yes.
We could argue that, yeah, that it's, you know, we have different sized farms, but both of us are just as trapped in this system, whether or not we want to be in it. So buying the votes really comes to how do these corporations see a way forward to make themselves more profitable and thus keep the power that they hold or grow the power.
Yeah. And I think, you know, when I was referring to farmers, I was referring to an example of size. Now, I expect it that if you're a beef packing company and you own 76% of the U.S. beef market, you have significant economies of scale there to have your way with the world. And so those are that is the force that I see when you're trying to decentralize agriculture. How do you go up against that economies of scale and the privileges that it brings?
Right, that's the big question. Well, first off, I want to say there's not a silver bullet. I don't think that's far-fetched. It's going to take a lot of different things at a lot of different scales. But that's the great thing about when we talk about power. If we talk about democratizing systems, meaning everybody gets a vote, then we can start to shift where the power is held and shift where decisions are made. So that can look like, on the ground, that can look like a cooperative, you know, a group of, let's use vegetables as an example. A group of vegetable farmers get together and say, you know, we can be a lot more successful if we work together, not trying to be, you know, apart. So one might argue, oh, that sounds a lot like consolidation. But the difference is, if those farmers all come together and they all have an equal vote, an equal decision-making power at that table, that's democratized. And it's serving those farmers, it's serving their communities. And that can just be in one spot. That can be in one county, or that can be in three counties. The thing is, if there's structures like that that work for all these different communities, then that's where we can start to democratize systems so folks can actually decide what they grow, or if you're a consumer, what you want to eat.
Well, having once been engaged in the garlic trade in the southern Rogue Valley of Oregon, I came to the conclusion that you have no control over the marketplace. You can put all of your garlic in a truck and haul it down to a big market like San Francisco and take it to the wholesaler, and he'll look at you and go, oh yeah, this is what I'll give you, and which won't be enough to make it worth your while. But you can organize a garlic co-op and build a name for your garlic, and then have people ask for your garlic instead of just asking for garlic, and then you have some control over the world. But what happened to all of those co-ops that used to dot the countryside of America? They seem to have disappeared.
It's seemingly so, right? So, you know, if we look at this more with meatpacking, what it's happened, it's kind of get big or get out. You know, as there was unchecked consolidation, and the way that that happens is through different types of integration and different types of mergers. But basically what happens is the big got bigger because there weren't strong antitrust enforcement. And that increased the economies of scale, where it didn't really matter if you were a cooperative structure or if you were a smaller corporation, you just couldn't keep up. And so we've seen that in cooperatives and meatpacking. We've seen that in farm size. So it really gets its roots back in, you know, antitrust and unchecked mergers.
Let's back up just a little bit and talk about the impact that consolidation has had on our rural communities. You, Emily, are from Iowa. Have you seen an impact on your community, on your rural communities in Iowa, from the consolidation of the food chain?
Absolutely. And I would say that's why I eventually made my way into this work. Growing up, while I didn't have a clue what consolidation was, I could see that, you know, I was in supposedly the breadbasket of the world. There were green plants growing all around me, and yet folks in my community were food insecure. So that was a question from a very young age. While I had no words, I could clearly see that it didn't make much sense. While I don't live in my hometown anymore, recently we've had, there'd been a fight over a confined animal feeding operation, a CAFO, where large number of hogs, up to 2,500, are grown in one building. And they wanted to build it 2 miles away from the elementary school. And that tore the community apart for months. So I certainly see that. I also see when I go home, not as many people live on my parents' section anymore, because the homesteads are going away to larger and larger fields. So it's a phenomenon that sits very close to home, and also one that we're working to address, and one that we know there are solutions where we can move forward for all rural communities.
I once did a food chain radio show from the Phil and Barbara Hamburger Farm in South Dakota. They had 25,000 acres of corn and soybeans. And, you know, their home was kind of like like an aircraft carrier. It was just incredible technology that allowed them to do this. Such a huge farm with a husband and wife and some occasional laborers. But after the show, I was driving through their little community, little town, and the town was having its Crazy Days sales, which is where all of the merchants put stuff out on the sidewalk and that they want to get rid of, and people come buy it. And I noticed some Boy Scouts selling hot dogs and soft drinks, so I stopped and bought a hot dog and some soft drinks. And I asked them, "How's business, guys?" And they said, "Well, you're our first customer." And this is like 2 o'clock in the afternoon. And the reason I was her first customer is that there was nobody left in that little town. It was sad, so sad. But it is the way it is, and that's just the consequence of consolidation. And all of those crops that used to be grown out there have been fine-tuned into commodity crops in which whoever grows the most for the least wins. Is that a fair summation of what happened?
Absolutely. We see rural places dealing with this depopulation and what is sometimes called this hollowing out. Right, because, you know, there's an example, if you watch the webinar Dr. Mary Hendrickson gives, of there was a farmer in Missouri who started with 500 acres but wanted to get bigger and bigger and, you know, 15 years later has many, many more acres, but doesn't have any neighbors left, right? Because they all had to go off the land. So we see consolidation working to hollow out these communities. It kind of removes the farmer from working with the land. You know, like you mentioned, you know, you have that combine that kind of works like an airplane. It's so technologically advanced, that it's really kind of removing the farmer from the land, and then we have this, hollowing out of rural mm-hmm. places. There just aren't as many people left.
Well, those who advocate for size, that the pursuit of the economies of scale, argue that this is good. This is getting people out of the drudgery of farming and putting them to work in the city where they can do much more beneficial laboring as opposed to working on the land. And so they point to the fact that it's more efficient and food is cheaper. How do you argue against that?
Yeah, well, that is a common argument. So a key word you used is efficiency, right?
Right.
The argument is made because this system is more efficient, less people producing more, and that it's better. But especially in the COVID-19 pandemic, we see that people aren't, even though we have this massive production, because things are so consolidated, you know, one processing plant is responsible for about 5% of pork processing. And then that closes down because workers are sick, like it did. This plant was in South Dakota. Then that leads to an estimated 300,000 pigs being euthanized because they didn't have a market to go to. So not to mention all of the workers in the processing plants who have contracted COVID, who have died because of COVID, And the companies didn't provide proper personal protective equipment or sick leave. But I mean, that's, you know, so that's the system that was built on the premise that this is supposed to be efficient and better for us, when in fact it's brittle, easily broken, and is egregious towards workers and farmers who have to make the difficult decision to euthanize thousands upon thousands of animals.
So when things are going right, they can go right. But when things go wrong, they can go really wrong, because everything is centralized in one place, and that can lead to very big trouble. We're going to take a quick break, but when we come back, how can we change that? How can we, or do we need to change that? What can we do to deal with the consolidation of everything? This is the Food Chain Radio program. Michael Olson. Today we're talking with Emily Miller and you. Right back.
You can earn a substantial income by farming for the city. All you need to do is take your crop to market and win the competition for the consumer dollars. There is a well-proven strategy for winning this competition. You will find it embedded in MetroFarm, the guide to growing in or near the city for the city.
Northland Berry News, Paul Otten.
What a book. It's obvious MetroFarm was not written by someone sitting in an ivory tower. It comes from the trenches, from the School of Hard Knocks. A superb job.
Ag reporter Nancy Barr. MetroFarm addresses just about every issue involved in planning, planting, growing, harvesting, packaging, transporting, and marketing of a crop.
Before you plant your seeds, pick up a copy of the Ben Franklin Book of the Year award-winning MetroFarm. Then plant your seeds and win the dollars. MetroFarm.com. MetroFarm.com. MetroFarm.com.
So much to say, so little time to say it, on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Well, Emily, top of the show, I said agriculture seems to me to be growing in two directions, very big and very small. It seems like if you are growing crops out there in the countryside, you're growing commodity crops out there in the countryside, you're pretty much going to have to get bigger, get out, because that's the name of the game. But if you're farming in or near the city for the city, you're not going to grow commodity crops. There's no reason to. You want to grow specialty crops, and therein lies a whole different world. That agriculture is loath to recognize. I think they're loath to recognize it because they don't want to compete with people who are farming in or near the city for the city. But there's one thing in your report that stopped me in my tracks, and I'm going to read it to you. And that was the author writes, there is no reason that we have to organize the food and agriculture system on a for-profit, efficiency, specialization-based system. But that is, in fact, what I have seen all the farmers I have ever worked with doing, trying to make money with their farms. How can we have agriculture if people aren't going to make money?
Well, that is a really important piece of the report. And kind of to touch a little bit back, you know, you mentioned we see maybe some smaller, more diversified farmers around cities, but, you know, we also see those specialized products being consolidated and being grown in places that aren't, you know, those smaller diversified farms. So those folks are having a hard time getting by too. But I think what we were trying to get to in the report is the for-profit basis. It doesn't need to be the first priority, nor should it, because it's that same for-profit efficiency prioritizing that's led to this large system. Again, you know, thousands of animals were euthanized while thousands of animals were being exported for folks to make money. So what we're getting at is, if other things were prioritized, like actually making sure people are fed, you know, in the U.S., folks are food insecure. So other things can come before making a profit. We're not saying that farmers shouldn't be worried about making a profit. They should be able to. They should have fair markets. They should be able to prosper in an economy that they contribute to.
And the best way to do that is to figure out how to make some money doing what you're doing.
You know, right.
I've had the occasion to work with some Shipibo Indians in the headwaters of the Amazon. And you know, they were sustainably harvesting medicinal herbs that were being sold here in the United States. And they loved the idea of making money and being able to build their community up and to have some luxuries like nice clothes and whatnot. But everybody wants to figure out how to make money. And so I think that those farmers close to the city have an opportunity where it's harder for those people out in the country. If you're out in the country, you can develop a co-op and then, you know, go about building your world with a co-op. But, you know, you're kind of stuck if you're not growing for a market itself. If you're growing for that, if you're growing commodities for the wholesale market, you have to compete with people who have the economies of scale and the benefits of those economies of scale, which often include, you know, favorable access to government.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I saw in your report that there was a mention of that favorable access to government by one group or another, and how that is actually determined what they could grow, because one group, or maybe that was a different article I read, but that competition for the market where you have access to the government is huge. Yet people are figuring out how to do that. So you also suggest that we need to come up with ways of that we can have a mix of large and small for-profit, non-profit, and public entities serving different roles in the food system. What does that mean?
Yeah, so that gets to your point, too, of you know, where opportunities are, opportunistic markets are for certain farmers over others. But it comes back to this idea of these multiple solutions that are really place-based and place-dependent. So talking about a broad variety of scales and solutions, a big solution that we see at Family Farm Action Alliance is antitrust enforcement, you know, kicking back the control and the closeness to the government that some of these corporations do have. So that's a big idea. That's a big thing we mm-hmm. can do. Other things we can do are...
Well, wait, how do you get at that when those big corporations are the ones who are sitting, you know, they have this rotating door. They go in and out the government, back and forth to mm-hmm. industry. So how do you get to them, and how do you get to the government to actually enforce antitrust on industry?
Right. Well, that takes us back to the Packards and Stockyards Act of 1921. There are provisions in there that have yet to be enacted and yet to be enforced. So by raising awareness and doing advocacy around that, if those things were to, in fact, be enforced, it would tick back the control and the importance of the economies of scale to get other voices and these alternate structures more to the fore and more in consciousness and, you know, for other farmers to see, oh, that system is working for other folks. Maybe we should try that. And adapt it to our own community, our own region. And, you know, that is to say these things are not impossible. You know, mm-hmm. this large consolidated system where a few folks are making decisions, It's done on purpose. Therefore, it can be undone on purpose. So that's where antitrust is kind of a lock key. But then with that can come in with these other alternative place-based structures, perhaps redirecting some subsidies away from massive monocultures that hurt the environment but are in fact sequestering carbon or reversing climate change. The possibilities are really endless when you start thinking about these solutions.
One solution that always strikes me that nobody ever talks about but me is no subsidies at all. If I believe that if agriculture were left on its own, those who grow the most efficiently would survive, and those that didn't would not survive. I am not sure that I think that when you subsidize something, anything, you distort its true value. And if there were no subsidies, I think those farmers who practice traditional agriculture, kind of along the lines of the Amish or metropolitan farmers or urban farmers, who are doing most of the work themselves, might do pretty darn good. But when they have to compete with other farmers who are getting massive subsidies, in many different kinds of subsidies, not just cash subsidies, but, you know, subsidized water, subsidized labor, subsidized pollution, everything. It's really hard for a farmer without subsidies to compete with farmers with subsidies. Does that make any sense?
It absolutely does make sense. You know, at Family Farm Action Alliance, we want to be there to protect all farmers. So we know that there are farmers that, you know, are getting these subsidies, you know, like you mentioned, not just on cash, but water, crop insurance, transportation. They are just doing what they were told however many years ago. So we don't want to leave them behind. We want to give all farmers an opportunity to transform the system in a just way. We don't just want to rip the floor out underneath a large portion of this nation's farmers. So
do you think we would be doing that?
We perhaps could be if we do huge things all at once.
We don't have to do everything at once, but if we started phasing out subsidies, and maybe people would wake up.
I think they would certainly wake up. I think they would also wake up and perhaps stand a little at attention to if those funds were redirected to something else, you know, such as combating climate change, which is, you know, if we don't act quickly, is going to have very, very large, I mean, it already has very large impacts, right? Mm-hmm. But would be devastating. So through many instruments such as redirects, perhaps stopping some programs, making other ones, we can make a just transition for all farmers to eventually find their way into a prosperous system that's based in local and regional farms.
I love the idea of local. It's my jihad, and I think if we all take good care of ourselves, we'll find a way of living without those subsidies.
In support of what Emily Miller has said about the consolidation of the food chain in the hands of a few, I offer the following snippet of a conversation I had with Canadian farmer Percy Smyser way back in Food Chain Radio number 672.
Folks, Percy Smyser woke up one morning to find himself a serf on his own land. It happened when the neighbor's Roundup Ready canola seed sprang to life under some power lines next to Percy's field up there in Rouneau, Saskatchewan. The Monsanto Corporation came along and said, "Percy, since you do not have a license to grow our Roundup Ready canola seeds, all of the canola in your fields and in your silos now belongs to us." And to date, the courts have agreed But now it's up to the Supreme Court to decide whether Percy Smizer stole Monsanto's Roundup Ready canola seeds or whether Monsanto's Roundup Ready canola seeds stole Percy Smizer's farm. No matter how you look at it, the answer to this question is going to prove monumental in its implications. Percy, you're not alone. You have people who are trying to help you out, right?
Right, yes.
And you call them interveners. Who are they?
Okay, in the Supreme Court, they allow interveners who are people, organizations, or concerned individuals all over the world that would have or could be affected by the outcome of this case. And it also could be governments. And to give you an example, there's two really important issues in my case that has implications around the world. And those are, first of all, should anyone have the right to patent a life form, like a gene? And the other issue, the rights of farmers always to use their own seed. So those are the two important issues. So there's interveners on my behalf from India, from Europe, from the United States, Canada, the Farmers Union, and also the government of Ontario, because they're very concerned if Monsanto would own the rights to all the patenting of genes and the patenting of life forms, it would stop all the future research and so on, except if it's under the control of a multinational. So that's why it's such a precedent-setting case, not only for Canadians, but for farmers and individuals around the world and governments.
Well, who's intervening on the behalf of Monsanto? Who's backing up Monsanto on
Well,
this?
You know, it's not hard. It's all the biotech industry of the world, and especially for Canada and the United States, all come down. And they have stated that even though I could be right in my case, they say that Monsanto should maintain the right to be able to patent life forms, control it, and the rights of farmers should be taken away. And that's their attitude. So it's the biotech industry versus the other people of the world, organizations and governments who do not want the patenting of life forms.
And the way this World Trade Organization is shaping up and the power being given that organization, if a person owns the patent to a Roundup Ready canola seed, for example, in Canada, they own it everywhere in the world, right?
Right, because
and the rules that affect you, for example, will also be the rules that will affect a farmer in India or one in Tierra del Fuego.
That's right, because patent laws are basically the same around the world, and I am told that Monsanto has about 80 countries in the world now to say about the same patent laws, giving them the control of life forms and the seeds.
We're going to talk with Pat right now, who wonders about this Monsanto Corporation. Pat, welcome to the Food Chain. Percy Smizer and Michael Olson, go ahead.
Yeah, pleasure to talk to both of you guys. I wish you both the best. Michael, you just really outdo yourself with the content and the guests on your shows. I wanted to wish you the very best, Percy. This sounds like the plot out of a James Bond movie with, the fiend versus you.
Pat, engineer Noah James just come running into the studio and says, this is too weird to be true.
Isn't it? I mean, if the courts do rule against you, Percy, I think there's this just might finally be the trigger that gets a whole lot of people fed up with the way things are. And, the way things are is that corporations are increasingly able to get away with what would have once been considered outrageous. I mean, this is just possibly a quantum leap beyond...
Emily, thank you so much for joining me. Emily Miller, Policy and Research Manager, Family Farm Action Alliance. Thank you so much for tuning in, and thank you all. Remember, Michael Olson's third law of the food chain, cheap food isn't. Thank you, Emily.
Thanks. It's been a pleasure, Michael.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with Michael Olson. And if your friends missed the show, tell them to log on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com for a listen. Now, go out and find some food with its farmer's face on it and live.